Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderley. This hour on the program, of course, the question we're going to ask is, our United States government neglecting our soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan? My guest will be journalist Aaron Glantz. He says that when American soldiers, when they return from those battles, they come back different, he says, from when they left for their military commitment. When they return, he writes, they have difficulty often relating to their families and friends who've never spent any time in a war zone. But Glantz charges that the federal government, rather than helping them adjust to civilian life, throws a series of barriers at veterans that makes their problems worse. He says injured veterans must battle with the Pentagon, first of all, for an honorable discharge, and then fight a Department of Veterans Affairs bureaucracy to get their health care, education, and disability benefits. He says that often the fight is so complicated that it pushes the veteran toward withdrawing, toward using drugs or even crime or suicide. But my guest says it doesn't have to be this way. We'll find out more. Aaron Glantz is an independent journalist whose work has appeared in the Nation, The Progressive, The San Francisco Chronicle, and more. He spent parts of 3 years as a journalist in U.S. occupied Iraq, in Baghdad, in Fallujah, in Najaf. His new book is The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. And Aaron Glantz is going to join us in just a few minutes. He is at WNYC, public radio station in New York, and I talked to him just a moment, just to let you give you a little insight on what goes on in terms of radio here. I talked to him just a moment ago on his cell phone because we couldn't get him at the studio number of WNYC, and he said he is locked out of the studio and can't find an engineer to get into the studio and is working with a receptionist to get to the studio. We are working, Open Line producer Linda Taylor is working from our end, and Amy Jurovich, our line producer, to see about getting him into the studio so we can conduct the interview. In the meantime, if we cannot, we will do so. Get Aaron on his cell phone, but as you know, cell reception is not often terribly satisfactory. Aaron makes the point in his book, he says, that indeed, when you spend time in a battle zone, as he has as a journalist, it's very, very different. He says that the sights you see and, frankly, the bodies, the wounded, the people you'd like to help but can't help, that these take a psychological toll on both soldiers and on journalists. And he said, in fact, the rate of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, is about the same in war-covering journalists as it is in soldiers. So he says it's really tough, and there's a tremendous mental health problem, he says, for thousands of returning veterans. And he says, in fact, the VA, the Veterans Administration, is not equipped to deal with it. He says they don't have enough mental health practitioners, for example. He says, in fact, they're geared toward really the problems of elderly veterans now from World War II, if you can believe that, and, of course, becoming elderly from the Vietnam War. And he charges that the Bush administration has cut back on veterans' benefits. He claims, in order to hide the true costs of the war and to build up public support, early on, the Bush administration, he says, cut back in terms of veterans' benefits. And he also says that a national network of VA hospitals and clinics seems to have been designed primarily, he says, to weed out fraud and to save money. And he says the Veterans Administration is dismissive of veterans' claims, often with overlapping bureaucracies. He says the bureaucracy is hostile, in fact, often to veterans. And he says the veteran needs to fight back to get benefits. In fact, he's got one case where a fellow came back and was looking for benefits for his battle injuries, and his father had to go to work for him, and he finally had to go to private charities. Private charities, he says, have sprung up all around the country to help vets from Afghanistan and Iraq and even from Vietnam, when in fact, he says, of course, given the fact that they've risked their lives for our country, it's the government that ought to be helping, but they're simply not necessarily set up to do it. There's a U.S. government study that says that almost 200,000 homeless veterans are sleeping on the street on any given night. Can you imagine that across the country? Almost 200,000 homeless veterans, homeless for various reasons having to do with their disabilities and in many cases a lack of treatment. They're sleeping on the street on any given night. And he also says that veterans can turn to crime because of post-traumatic stress disorder. We'll find out how that happens. And he says also this book The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, is not an easy book to write because he says it brought up all kinds of memories that he had of the war as a journalist, of all the sights that he saw that are so terrible in warfare. So we're working to get Aaron Glantz into the studio at WNYC, and his new book is The War Comes Home. It's subtitled Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, and we have a... in just a moment here, we have a message that Aaron Glantz will be in the studio at WNYC in about 2 minutes. Is that right, Linda? And so we will talk for another couple of minutes here, and then we'll be talking with Aaron to get a firsthand report. I'm really summarizing some of the things that that you read. You will read if you read his book, The War Comes Home. I want to mention in the second hour of the show that Harvey Wasserman will be joining us, longtime environmental activist, anti-nuclear activist. He's got a new book out called Solartopia, in which he says we're going to have a green energy future with lots of solar energy and wind energy and geothermal and tidal energy, energy that's renewable, energy that's cheap, energy that doesn't despoil the environment, and energy that he says will promote a very, very green and prosperous economy. And Harvey Wasserman joining us in our studio, the second hour of the show. Waiting once again here for Aaron Glantz, stalling essentially till Aaron gets to the studio and trying to be as informative as possible. Tomorrow, we're going to have a panel of local economists on Open Line for the 10 o'clock hour. And they're going to be giving us a local economic forecast for Columbus and for Central Ohio. So they're going to be with us on the show tomorrow. Also, John Mueller is going to be joining us from our political science department here at The Ohio State University. And John will be talking about all kinds of challenges for U.S. foreign policy for the incoming Obama administration, talking about, of course, the current combat in the Middle East, in the Gaza, talking about Afghanistan, to which, in fact, Barack Obama has said he will send more troops, and talking about Iraq as well, from which Barack Obama promises to withdraw. So we'll have those two shows for you tomorrow. And we're also working to get the Ohio EPA director with us, the new director under the Strickland administration. Of course, we're going to have a panel of State House reporters on the show later in the week, talking about, among other things, the Ohio economy. I don't know if you noticed this, but Governor Strickland was quoted as saying that he would have to cut back all departments in the federal government, the state government, 25%. If the federal government doesn't come through with some monies. So, indeed, that's the deal. 25% cutback if the federal government and the Obama administration don't come through with money. But, in fact, the Obama administration has promised money for all the states. Governor Strickland got on the phone with Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff for President-elect Obama, the other day, and said he wanted $5 billion. That's the kind of money we're going to have in the economy. And so those are among the issues we're going to discuss with our State House reporters. Well, we're really not, at this point, apparently getting anywhere, getting Aaron Glantz on the phone. So if we have no update here, Linda and Amy, what have we got? Are we getting Aaron on the phone, or are we going to go to an open phones? We're getting a pantomime. Linda, come on to the studio, and we'll find out what's happening with Aaron. Linda Taylor, what's the latest? We're calling Aaron on the phone, and we expect her to be in the studio of a WNYC. Okay. So we will give you the rundown on that in just a second. But we'll have our local economists on the panel tomorrow, headed by Bill Lafayette, who's the economic forecaster for the Columbus Chamber of Commerce. And as you know, the city closing 12 recreation centers, among other things. And, of course, with, I would imagine, nobody in the Coleman administration wants to close the 12 recreation centers. It's going to be disastrous for kids around the city who have very few places to go and play safely and stay out of trouble, and many other possibilities for the city that I'm sure nobody wants to be enacting. But the fact is that a lot of that is going to be closing. So Aaron Glantz, once again, he is was in Baghdad and Fallujah and Najaf. He was there for parts of 3 years. He's written for The Nation and the progressive liberal magazines, for the San Francisco Chronicle, the morning newspaper in San Francisco. His new book, The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. He's an independent journalist. He's currently a Rosalind Carter Fellow for Mental Health Journalism at the Carter Center in Atlanta. Tell you what we're going to do, Amy. I'm going to open the phones here for a brief open forum because we're not having any luck getting through to Aaron. And let us at 614-292-8513 if you'd like to talk about any of these issues. And we'll get Aaron on the line as soon as we can. But feel free to call in to talk about whatever you'd like to talk about. Maybe you're a veteran who tuned in today and maybe you've had some difficulty getting treatment, or maybe on the other hand you've done very well with the Veterans Administration. Maybe you'd like to talk about Israel's current offensive in the Gaza Strip against Hamas, and Hamas rockets, of course, continuing to fall into Israel in greater numbers, Israel's ground troops attacking, and that conflict continuing on, and it seems... Well, you know, you hope for a solution. You hope for a cessation of hostilities on both sides, and we can all hope, and that's about all we can do. But we do have Aaron Glantz with us now, I do believe, from WNYC in New York. Aaron Glantz, welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
It's good to be with you.
All right. And, Aaron, thanks so much for coming on with us. And your book, The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. Aaron, you say, and I'm going to quote directly from the book, it's possible for wounded soldiers to get both quality and prompt care from the Pentagon and Department of Veterans Affairs medical assistance, but getting that care usually means a fight. Why is there a fight?
Well, why is there a fight is a very good question, but the first thing for people to understand is the tremendous fight that people have to go through and just realize the nature of it. There are veterans from the Vietnam War who are still fighting their claims for post-traumatic stress disorder or exposure to Agent Orange that are now 37 years old. There are Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans who have committed suicide or become homeless because they can't get into that VA system. And the entire system is set up in such a way to make sure that nobody is trying to defraud it rather than to provide care for those who have risked so much for our country.
You would think, Aaron, that a soldier would just come home and if he claimed to be suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder or from traumatic brain injury, and there was the least bit of evidence that that could be true, that they would just take him or her into the system and worry about fraud maybe a little bit later on and get him some treatment.
Well, you know, that's the way we handle our taxes, right? We file our taxes. The IRS believes that we're telling the truth. And then they go back and audit us. And if it turns out we didn't deserve that refund that we got, they take it away from us and they punish us. And if it turns out we're telling the truth, then we get to keep our refund. But if you can just imagine the way our tax system would work, if it was set up the way the VA is set up, it would just be a nightmare. And it's a nightmare for our veterans. And it's unconscionable that we now have 600,000 wounded veterans in this country who are waiting to get into this system, waiting to find out if the government will give them a disability check, or waiting for an appointment to see a physician or a psychiatrist at the VA. And it's very unfortunate, but that's the way our system works. And that's why I called the book The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, because every step of the way, when a wounded soldier comes home, and he wants to get care for the wounds he sustained in combat, he has to fight. He has to battle to get that care.
Tell me, do veterans with mental health problems like post-traumatic stress disorder and other mental problems as a result of the war, do they have trouble getting diagnosed by the Veterans Administration? I mean, do they have to fight for that as well?
Well, they have trouble getting in to see a doctor. I mean, you can't get diagnosed unless you have the opportunity to see a doctor. And one of the tragedies of this war, we've talked a lot about how the Bush administration failed to plan to properly execute this war and how the war has not gone on the battlefield the way that some people would have hoped or predicted 6 years ago. Well, the Bush administration also failed to prepare to treat the wounded from this war. So here we are, 6 years into the war in Iraq, 7 years into the war in Afghanistan, and we are now seeing the effects of the fact that the Bush administration failed to hire any doctors, failed to hire any psychiatrists to take care of the soldiers who are wounded. One of the soldiers that I profile in my book Sergeant G.J. Cassidy from Indiana had a traumatic brain injury in Iraq. He was in a Humvee that was attacked by a roadside bomb. He had a physical head injury. He had bleeding inside of his head. He was evacuated to Europe and eventually was supposed to be receiving care at Fort Knox in Kentucky, but he didn't receive any care at Fort Knox. Instead, he was just warehoused in his room on the base. Nobody checked in on him to see how he was doing, and he died sitting in his chair in his room at Fort Knox. And the autopsy report prepared by a doctor hired by his family indicated that he had been sitting in his room dead for 3 days before anyone found him on a U.S. military base in the United States of America.
Hmm. Aaron, you write that one of the problems is that a number of people who are mental health practitioners don't think of being with the Veterans Administration as a very good career for various reasons, and they're not interested. Why is that?
Well, we have two problems. It's important for people to realize that there are actually two systems. There's the system set up by the Veterans Administration. That's the system that you get in or you try to get in once you're out of the military. And then there's a separate system for while you're in the military. The Pentagon has its own medical system. And one of the problems is, that I discussed is getting from one system into the other system and not falling through the cracks in the middle. And that's when a lot of families have to take on a lot of debt and pay cash for health care. But the military is having a tremendous problem hiring doctors and psychiatrists because, of course, you've always been able to make a lot more money in private practice than you can make working for the government. But now there's this other thing, which is that if you join the military as a psychiatrist, you might get deployed to Iraq. You might get deployed to Afghanistan along with all the other guys, and that may not be why you went to graduate school.
And so you resist such a job for that reason. And by the way, you say you quote statistics, by March of 2008, over 130,000 Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans had been diagnosed, they got to the doctor with a psychological illness by the VA's mental health services. And of course, there are many more remaining, as you would suggest, undiagnosed, huh?
Well, the RAND Corporation, which is a very well-respected think tank, their estimate is that we have over 300,000 veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder or major depression. And then we have another 300,000 veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan who have suffered a traumatic brain injury. That is that they are suffering physical brain damage, loss of memory, internal bleeding to their head, multiple concussions. And so altogether, 600,000 people suffering from these wounds. But as you allude to, only 130,000 of them have been diagnosed. Only 130,000 of these 300,000 with PTSD have been able to access the system. That means that the other half are getting no care at all.
Hmm. With me, journalist Aaron Glantz, his new book, The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. Let's go to our phones. Chuck is on the air. Hello, Chuck.
Good morning, Fred. Thank you so much for this show. Just make a quick comment. I'm a casualty of Vietnam. Went 30 years before getting treatment. The VA is so underfunded that even though they wish to do a good job, it's difficult. I have never applied for benefits. All I'm concerned about is getting the mental health advice that I can get through the system. I was a Marine officer in Vietnam during Khe Sanh, had a rifle company, and I had an awful lot of people that sustained a lot of injuries and other things, and I feel just lucky that mine was my ability to get along in society with my major problem. So I think we just need to keep this up front in front of society so people understand. And we've got to get these young folks treated immediately so that we don't pay a lot more in societal costs later.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much.
Okay, Aaron, your comments?
Well, I think the caller is very right. And first of all, I want to thank him for his service. And, you know, maybe he mentions that he has not applied for benefits for his post-traumatic stress disorder. And the reason is because the system is so hostile. You know, if you come back from Iraq and you have sustained a you have seen your buddies die in front of you. You have seen Iraqi people die and not be able to do anything about it. You have sustained multiple IED blasts and are still reeling from that. When you come back to the United States, the very first thing that the government makes you do is fill out a 26-page form where you describe how it is exactly that you've been traumatized. And this is in order to get into the system.
Hmm.
And one of the really sad things is that, you know, one of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder is that you block out those traumatizing events because they're so difficult for you to wrestle with. And the point of the therapy, the point of the thing that you need to do in recovery is to rationalize those things, to be able to really think about them and get beyond them. But our system makes you do that in order to get in the front door.
Chuck, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Does that ring true to you?
It certainly does. I don't even have any idea of what an evaluation of me has been. I just know that, generally speaking, treatment has been efficacious for me, and that the VA people care, but they are overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. I know of a staff sergeant that was not be able to be treated effectively and took his own life not long ago, and had been a Silver Star awardee from Iraq. So it's an ongoing problem, and until society views it as a real concern, I think it'll continue.
Okay, Chuck, thanks for your call.
Sure.
Aaron, Chuck says until society views it as a real concern. Do you think that tell me about the mass media in this regard. Have we not given sufficient coverage to this issue?
Well, I think there's certainly been some very good stories. Many people probably know about the Washington Post expose about the deplorable conditions at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C. There have been a number of other excellent stories published by journalists over time. But we don't have the same commitment to covering this issue that we do to other issues. You know, most major newspapers in this country will have an environment reporter. Most major newspapers in this country will have a Pentagon reporter. These reporters do nothing but cover the Pentagon or the business world or the environment. We have nobody who covers the veterans after they come home on a daily basis. When I started working on this book 2 years ago, I felt sure that by the time it came out, somebody else would have written a similar book.
Yeah.
But the fact that nobody has, to me, is an indication that I'm operating in a pretty lonely terrain as a journalist who's focusing on this on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. And it's that day-to-day focus that we're going to need if we're going to tackle this problem.
Sure. We're going to take a brief break here for a couple of announcements. Once again, my guest, journalist Aaron Glantz, whose new book is The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. And we're finding out how, indeed, veterans can get quality care from the Pentagon and from the Department of Veterans Affairs Medical Systems, but that getting that care usually means a fight and sometimes a protracted fight. We'll be back with my guests, your phone calls and emails after these messages at WOSU 820 NPR News.
Go for rich conversation on the topics that matter most. The radio is more responsive than the water cooler, and we take your calls. I'm Neil Conan. If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. Join us for provocative talk on the issues you really care about. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk Talk of the Nation begins later this afternoon at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. I'm Amy Jarovich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. When you don't have time to catch the whole story, get an update with the WOSU Daily News Loop. Receive award-winning local coverage and NPR headlines emailed every weekday right to your inbox. Catch up with current events or listen to a story you missed. Don't miss a beat with the WOSU Daily News Loop. To sign up, go to wosu.org/email.
Support for WOSU comes from Marburn Academy, a forward-thinking school for ADHD and or dyslexic students, offering a 1st through 12th grade curriculum. More about their college preparatory high school at marburnacademy.org.
And taking a look at the weather forecast, mostly sunny skies today and a high around 37, partly cloudy tonight and a low of 23. For tomorrow, a good chance of afternoon rain and a high of 39. Currently, 28 degrees in downtown Columbus. And now, back to Open Line with Fred Anderle.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle, talking with Aaron Glantz, independent journalist whose new book, The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. And we're having some difficulty again with our phone system at our public radio station, WNYC in New York. We've lost our guest, Aaron Glantz. We were talking with him on the cell phone, and we're going to try and get him back here in just a few minutes. But as you can see, and as Chuck, our veteran who called in, suggested, it's often a very difficult fight for people to, in fact, get the treatment that they need, our injured veterans, especially for mental illness. And much more money needs to be spent. And according to Chuck and according to Aaron Glantz, and we're going to find out some of the other things that need to be done as well. Right now, we seem to be having difficulty both with WNYC in New York and maybe also with our lines here in the studio. But Aaron, do we have you back here?
Yes, you do. Thank you.
Aaron, thanks so much. Okay, we're just having all kinds of phone difficulties, but we thank you for your patience, and we thank our listeners for theirs as well, and let's continue our conversation. So Chuck said in his call that, gee, a lot more money needs to be spent. But it's more than that, isn't it? There's a whole culture of treatment here that needs to change. Am I right?
Well, I think that what we need to do is we need to start by saying we need to care for our veterans, instead of starting by saying, what can we do with the amount of money we have? You know, imagine if we did Social Security that way. We said, well, we don't have enough money, so this month everyone's just going to get $12 who's retired in America.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way we do the VA. We decide how much money we're going to spend, and then we treat the veterans with that money. And then in order to use that money, we have to put up barriers, because if we just gave everyone the care that we need, we would go way over budget. So it's looking at it from a perspective of, these are people who served our country, who were wounded, who come home, and who deserve care, rather than looking at it from the perspective of, you know, how can we get away with spending as little money as possible on this? And I think there's a cultural issue for our country as well. After the Vietnam War, I think one of the reasons that veterans didn't get the care that they deserved was because the nation wanted to move on. The nation was tired of Vietnam. The nation was exhausted of the war. You know, Ronald Reagan promised this morning in America, it wouldn't have been pleasant to think about all of those, you know, millions of wounded Vietnam veterans. So we didn't do anything. And as a result, we have 200,000 veterans sleeping homeless on the street every night. And if we just try to forget about the Iraq War the way we tried to forget about the Vietnam War, then we're going to have a similar disgrace repeat itself all over again.
But it's amazing to me that, you know, we our elected officials give this lip service, you know, our men and women in uniform, we support our troops, and they talk on and on about supporting the troops, and yet, and they come home and they don't. And as you say, they allocate a certain amount of money, and they don't think about the care necessary. Why the hypocrisy?
Well, I think that we get back to the media again. The media is not shining a consistent light on these issues. So earlier we mentioned the excellent coverage that the Washington Post did about Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Excellent expose. The president is forced to comment. The Senate leaders on both parties promised to intervene and solve the problem. But where were they for the years before that in the media when the president was privatizing the care that was being offered at Walter Reed Army Medical Center? And where have they been since to ensure that the president and the Senate leaders are actually doing what they said they would do? And so we in the media need to do our best to raise the issue, as you're doing on this program, and the public needs to have an appetite for it. One of the real tragedies is that the media coverage of the war in Iraq in total has collapsed in this last year with the economy, with the election. It's down to 1 or 2% of all news stories. And it's really dangerous because we have, as I said, hundreds of thousands of wounded veterans coming home. We have 1.8 million veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan now. And for them, the story is just beginning.
Well, let us go back to our phones with Alan. Hello, Alan.
Yes, I've got a question. I'm a Vietnam vet, or Vietnam-era vet, though I didn't get sent to Vietnam. But I understand back in 2002, unbeknownst to me, if you weren't on the medical veterans medical benefits, you're off and can't get back on. Is that true, and is there any way of getting back on to the medical benefits that I might be available being a vet?
You never lose your ability to get these benefits.
Really?
There are all these deadlines, and this is probably one of them, that cause you to have to go back into the system and file a lot more paperwork. And so if I was looking into this for myself or a member of my family, what I might do is call my local county veteran service officer, you know, who might be with the American Legion or Disabled American Veterans, and ask them about this and how it might specifically apply in your case.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay, Alan, thank you for your call. By the way, our number is 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline at WOSU.org. Aaron Glantz with us. The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. Aaron, you charged that the Bush administration some time ago cut back on veterans' benefits, you say, to hide the true cost of the war and build up public support. Tell me about that charge.
Well, you remember back in 2002 when they were building support for this war, they told us it would be a cakewalk in Iraq. Donald Rumsfeld said it would be over in weeks rather than months. Here we are 6 years later. If they had told us that it would take 6 years and so many American and Iraqi lives, perhaps many American people would have thought differently back then. And so one of the things that happened in those misrepresentations that happened back in 2002 is that some very good civil servants at the Department of Veterans Affairs went to their bosses, the political appointees of the Bush administration, and told them, look, you're starting a war. There will be casualties. We need to hire doctors. We need to hire psychiatrists. And they refused. Instead, what the Bush administration did is actually fired his Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Anthony Principi, who made those requests. And he brought in a guy, Jim Nicholson, who major qualification as VA secretary was that he had, as chair of the Republican National Committee in 2000, mastermind George Bush's victory in the Florida election, which gave him the presidency, but no particular expertise in caring for wounded veterans. The only expertise that he brought was his willingness to keep his mouth shut about the true casualties of this war.
Hmm. You write that there are a series of private organizations that have sprung up to aid veterans and to essentially raise money for them when they can't get care through the systems that are supposed to care for them. And you even have a list of these organizations in your book, and some of them are reputable, and many of them are reputable, and some are not. Tell us a little bit more about this private charity system.
Well, I wanted the book to be helpful when I wrote it, and so I know that there are two things that we need to do. The first is to improve this system at the Department of Veterans Affairs, to make it easier for veterans to access, to ensure that when veterans get in the system, they get the help they need, and that's a political book. But in the meantime, we have millions of veterans, 25 million Americans are veterans in this country that need help. And so I have 24 boxes with different resources for different things, whether it's post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury, whether you need help with a home, whether you need help with a lawyer. All of these organizations are springing up around the country. Many have existed for a long time. Many are brand new. And many are founded by veterans themselves. One of the groups that I profile is Salute, Inc., which was headquartered out of Chicago, the Beiersdorfs. And Will Beiersdorf was a National Guardsman who deployed to Guantanamo after 9/11. And he was working for Siebel Systems, which is a high-tech company. And they refused to pay the difference in his salary between the very low amount of money he was getting in the Guard while deployed and the relatively higher amount of money that he was making at Siebel. So he had to actually take a tremendous pay cut to deploy, and it was very difficult for his family. And when he deployed, they got so much support in their community in suburban Chicago that when he returned, they decided to start a charity organization called Salute to help others in a similar situation. And they've organized runs, they've organized pizza parties, and they have helped veterans from around the country get assistance in terms of going to the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago, which is one of the premier institutes in this country for treating traumatic brain injury, in terms of helping their family members come to Chicago as well and finding them a place to stay and, you know, giving them a little bit of financial help. And I'm really glad that Will and Mary Beth Beiersdorf are doing such great things for their fellow Americans. But this is really the kind of thing that the government should be doing for those who have won the battle.
Aaron, you have some personal stories in the book about Eric Edmondson, severely wounded in an IED attack, an improvised explosive device, and what his father, Ed, had to do to support him, how he had to quit his job. Well, tell us what they went through.
Well, I mean, the Edmondsons are a very good story to think about because he did end up getting Eric Edmondson, who survived this attack in Iraq and ended up severely disabled. They did get all the help that they need after a tremendous struggle. His father, Ed, was a supervisor at ConAgra Foods in North Carolina, and he had to quit his job to care full time for his son when his son came home. When Eric Edmondson came home from Iraq, he was sent to the VA hospital in Richmond, Virginia, but he was put on a ward where he mostly had a lot of aging World War II vets, and Eric was told that he would never be able to talk again, that he was basically going to be a vegetable for the rest of his life, and the VA doctors in Virginia were just trying to manage his illness rather than help him recover. So what his father Ed did, he quit his job, and he basically worked full-time to help his son fight the system, got him into the Rehabilitation Institute in Chicago, hooked up with Will and Mary Beth Beiersdorf of Salute, Inc., who I mentioned earlier, and was eventually able to relate to his children. Eric Edmondson, who had been told that he was only going to be a vegetable, was eventually able to get around very well with the help of a wheelchair. Ed Edmondson also worked with Homes for Our Troops, which is a nonprofit organization that has been featured on Extreme Makeover Home Edition on television, got a new home built for him in North Carolina that is handicap accessible so he can get all around the house and do some of his own chores. But as you listen when I'm telling the story, he didn't really get any help from the government. Everything had to be done from Ed's perspective.
Let me ask you, Aaron, you say you note the fact that journalists who cover war have almost the same rate of post-traumatic stress disorder as do soldiers. And you said this is a very difficult book for you to write and that serving as a journalist in the war zones of Iraq was very difficult. I know you can't, we can't know what it's like because we haven't been there, those of us who haven't. But what can you tell us? Why is war so devastating to the people who serve in it?
Well, war is about people killing other people. I mean, that's the sad truth of it. Once you take away all the politics, there are wars that we need to fight and wars that we don't need to fight. But even a good war involves people killing other people. And You know, me as a journalist, I was over in Iraq from 2003 to 2005. I was unembedded. I walked the streets of Baghdad and Fallujah interviewing Iraqis about what they felt of the war that was going on around them. I saw a lot of the same things these soldiers saw. I can remember one of the ones that sticks with me is this woman who had been killed in the U.S. aerial bombardment of Fallujah in April 2004. And the war had been so fierce that her family had been unable to bury her. And they, that she had just been sitting, rotting in the middle of the street for weeks. And the day I arrived, there was a team of medical volunteers wearing surgical masks that was finally coming to pick her up. And I can remember now the stench. I can remember now the sight of it. I can remember the look in the boy's eye who was helping on that surgical team, seeing him, knowing he was 12 years old, and already he was carting around the rotting corpses of dead women. These are the things that you see in a war. And then you come back to the United States, and I came back in 2005. Everyone was concerned about the latest iPod, the latest electronic gadget. Nobody wanted to really talk about the war. Now the economy's gone south, so people are worried about how to keep their home. They're worried about how to keep their job. They're worried they might be able to find a new job. But here you are, and you've gone through this incredibly intense experience, and the country's attention is elsewhere.
Could our news media, as a general rule, do a better job at helping all of us back home understand what all of you over there, soldiers and journalists covering the war, are going through?
Well, I think so, and we've talked a little bit about that earlier, but I think a lot of this falls to citizens as well. This is a very strange war. There's no draft. Only 1% of Americans, less than 1%, have served in the war or have a direct family member, you know, a brother or a sister or father who served in this war. And so for the rest of us who are not personally connected, we owe it to our country and to those who serve to step up and pay attention and to make time. Because, you know, our college campuses are filling up with veterans. There are 300,000 veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan who are using their GI Bill right now. They're feeling isolated on campus in the same way that I was describing earlier. You know, we need to support them with veterans clubs. We need to have events for them so that they can talk on campus about their experiences. We need to attend community events where these folks are speaking. We as citizens need to engage this issue. We need to make time to understand and not, you know, I lay out a very big indictment of our government in the book, but when you talk to veterans, there's often a lot of rage at civilian society, the broader society, of apathy, and that's very important as well.
Maybe we're getting a little better in terms of us citizens. I talked just yesterday to a combat veteran of Vietnam who told me literally that I'd heard stories about this, but this is the first-hand story that I heard, who said that when he came back to his home in Los Angeles in uniform, somebody accosted him and called him a baby killer. You know, I'd never quite heard that directly from a person to whom that was said. We're not doing that anymore, at least.
Well, you know, it's very funny. I was at a forum in Washington, D.C. a few months ago, and Ken Burns was speaking, and he, you know, who made this incredible multi-part series on PBS about World War II. And he had, after the film showing, a panel. He had a Vietnam veteran, a World War II veteran, and an Iraq War veteran. And the World War II veteran said, "When I came home, I was a hero." And when the Vietnam veteran spoke, he said, "When I came home, they spat on me." And when the Iraq War veteran spoke, he said, "When I came home, nobody cared." I think that that's where we are. You know, people who served in this war are not coming home to a country that's engaged with the war. And that has a very big effect on the lives of the soldiers when they come home. It makes it harder for them to reintegrate with their family. It makes it harder for them to relate to their boss when they get a job in civilian society or with their classmates at school. Makes it harder for them to navigate the VA system because the bureaucrats, the VA, who are the gatekeepers, know that they aren't under the public microscope. So just paying attention and being more engaged as a society, I think, would make a tremendous difference.
We have an email from Hal. He says, isn't neglect of returning veterans an Anglo-American tradition? Shays' Rebellion in the 1780s in western Massachusetts was by unpaid returning soldiers whose land was being foreclosed to be bought, among others, by officers who were paid. Has there ever been an American war, Hal asks, in which returning soldiers were not neglected? Maybe, he says, World War II is exempted. What do you think?
Well, I think that he's very right. I would add to World War II, the Civil War, the soldiers who fought on our side of the North in the Civil War, on the Union side, were also cared for very well. And I would say that the common element, actually, between the Civil War and World War II is that they both occurred at very unstable points in our history. The Civil War, of course, our country was torn apart, and there were millions of armed men, and the government was worried that if they didn't get the care they deserved, that they might continue fighting a war against Washington. And after World War II, it's difficult to recall this now from the point we're at, but we had just been through the Depression. The economy had only been rebounded during World War II. We had defeated Germany and Japan, but people were very worried in this country about Russia and the possibility that there might be a communist revolution in the United States. And policymakers in Washington were very worried that if these veterans, millions of them, did not get the care they deserved, that they might turn on the government and see more in Russia than they saw in the United States. This was very much in the policy circles in Washington in discussion, and I talk about it in the book in detail. You contrast those two wars with virtually every other war that we've been involved with, and we have always treated the veterans. The Vietnam veterans had to fight 30 years to get recognized for the fact that they were poisoned with Agent Orange. The Korean War veterans were forgotten about completely. The Gulf War veterans, 17 years after the Persian Gulf War, are still fighting to get Gulf War syndrome recognized as a real, quote-unquote, illness, even though the Pentagon's own doctors estimate that 175,000 Gulf War veterans suffer from Gulf War syndrome. And with the veterans returning home from Iraq and Afghanistan, as we've been discussing, many are committing suicide because they can't gain access to the VA system. We have homeless Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans already sleeping on the street. And we have only about half of those wounded in the line of combat, whether it's post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury or something else, only about half getting the care that they need.
Journalist Aaron Glantz with us for several more minutes here. The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, his new book. We're joined by Mitch. Hello, Mitch.
Good morning. My question is, don't you think there's a disconnect between the American citizen's view as the soldiers as a patriot and the failure to recognize the work of a soldier is to kill? And I am a veteran, so I think the reason we never reconcile this is we just pretend that soldiers go over there and do works of charity, when in fact it's a very nasty, cruel, and inhumane job, and then expect them to come home and walk back into civilian life as if they never saw anything that was nasty.
Aaron, what about that?
I think you're very right. I think that when we talk about supporting the troops, it is not supporting the troops to ignore the work that they're doing overseas. Because the first part of supporting someone is understanding what they've been through. And as I said early, some wars are necessary, some wars are unnecessary, but every war is brutal. And even if you're on the right side of the war doing work that's morally right, it still involves killing other people and sometimes killing innocent civilians. And I think that one of the disconnects that we have is the public's unwillingness to think about that. And I think that that's one reason why a lot of these big newspapers don't have reporters that cover veterans. Because if they did, they would be constantly digging up the pain that these brave soldiers went through overseas and are still dealing with, now that they're veterans, and we as a society are reluctant to go there on an ongoing basis.
Mitch, what do you think?
Well, I think that's true, and I think the pressure needs to be applied against everyday American citizens. We can holler about the bureaucrats and all the rest of it, but the real failure is with we, the American citizen. You know, it outrages me when I see 4-year-old kids walking around in combat fatigues. And the job is nasty. It's the worst thing we do to any human being, and we American citizens continually fail to question our leaders and demand excellent justifications for what when they commit our people to this horrible crime against humanity. And I don't think anybody holds the American people responsible, and we're the responsible people.
All right, Mitch, thanks for your call. Mm-hmm. And our next caller here is Carol. Hello, Carol.
Yeah, you know, I have, as I said, a very different viewpoint. Of course, I'm on this war. My husband's whole family lives in Baghdad. And some of the thoughtless, horrible things that were said to him when we were blowing the heck out of that city was just amazing. The American people, I do understand that they are not, have not been, they are not allowed to be exposed to the sight of bloody bodies. They don't, they're not allowed to be told that American soldiers in the heat of war have committed atrocities. Both sides, I understand you, but American soldiers are always, never, you know. And we need to show people the dirty, filthy, miserable side of war. And where do you do it but on television and the newspapers? But if you see a picture that might gross somebody out in the newspaper, you'll be inundated with letters about how horrible it was to open the paper and see this. But if you don't see it, if it isn't forced down your throat, you're going to ignore it. And this war reminded me of an old Star Trek show way back where they get involved with this, this country or this planet that's fighting a war by computer. So the computer comes up and it tells you, oh, you've been hit. You go walk in, and they walk into these machines and are incinerated. They never see any blood, or you know, so they're not pushed to do anything about it. And the American people thought this was a great thing. I can tell you, I can just tell you the people that have just said, oh, this is great. We're blowing the heck out of Baghdad. And my husband says my whole family lives there. They don't see it. They don't get it. They don't want to get it. It was a glorious thing. And I just think that if you don't see the misery and the pain and the blood and the guts, you're not going to care. And
well, let me just say, Aaron, it seems to be that our coverage, television coverage of the Vietnam War was a lot more frank. You saw American soldiers injured and dying. You saw Vietnamese civilians who had been caught in crossfire, etc. You don't see any of that anymore.
No, you don't really. I mean, part of that is situation over there is so dangerous. It's a funny situation because I was over there in Iraq from 2003 to 2005 doing the kind of coverage that Carol is demanding. But one reason I'm not over there anymore is because it's so dangerous. And a lot of my colleagues have pulled out as well. Some of the major media outlets have pulled out because so many journalists have been harmed, kidnapped, killed, both by the insurgents and the terrorists and also by sometimes by the American troops by accident. I wish Carol's family well. I hope they stay safe. And one of the things about the care of American veterans is that I see it as very linked to ensuring the quality of life for the Iraqi people. I say, how can we think that we are doing anything good for people in a foreign country if we can't even take care of our own when they come back from the war?
Mm-hmm. Carol, thanks for your call. We just have a minute left, Aaron. I wanted to, you know, talk a little bit about education, the GI Bill, you know, the famous after World War II for sending so many people through college and onto successful lives, cut back quite a bit, some improvements lately in these kinds of education programs. Can you give me a brief snapshot?
Well, I would say very briefly that the GI Bill is one area where we have won this time around. Last year, Senator James Webb was able to get through a bill over the objections of President Bush that expanded the GI Bill. And now, for the first time since World War II, veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan will be able to get a full ride to college and university when they return home. And that kicks in this coming fall. So if you use your GI benefits after August of this year, then you can get a full ride in college.
Okay. Journalist Aaron Glantz, his new book, The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against American Veterans. You can find out more if you read the book. Aaron, thanks so much for being with us from New York City this morning.
Thank you.
When we come back, environmental activist Harvey Wasserman join us on our green energy future ahead on listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.